So, lesson 9, Nehemiah 8 and 10. So today's strength. So we've talked about our strengths being the walls. Does anybody remember the two strengths that we've talked about so far?
Strength.
Unity. And last week's?
Oh, gosh.
Fear.
Fear of God. Right. Fear of God rather than fear of man. So those are our two strengths that really help us to protect the integrity of God's presence, to keep it pure and to make it accessible, which is our whole reason for having those walls and gates. So this week, the strength is joy. And I think we have a lot of misconceptions about joy. Hopefully this will alleviate some of those. But as he goes through the whole thing, he's really talking about the joy of the Lord being a strength for us. So we start with the first part of 8. And 8 we had looked at in Ezra already. But now let's look at it from that point of view of joy. So at first they're preparing for joy. So they start with, notice, praise and worship. And I'm just going to delineate that for a minute, because we talk about worship. We've been talking about worship. Worship being that physical manifestation of submission, which usually means to bow, right? And yet when we talk about worship in this culture, we're really talking about praise. So praise is that time when you stand up, when you sing, when you shout, when you raise your hands. All of that is praise. And the difference between praise and worship is that praise is actually telling one another about God. It's explaining how great he is and how wonderful he is. And it's really what it is, what praise really is a call to one another to come into his presence. So it's a call to come. And you'll notice in scripture, particularly in the Old Testament, all the singing and praising was happening coming to the temple and within the gates, but not within the Holy of Holies or in the holy place. So it was the uniting together. And what I love about that idea is that when we're singing praises and we're singing about how wonderful God is, we're actually telling everybody, hey guys, we're all about one purpose. This is this unifying, it eliminates us focusing on our dissimilarities. It reminds us of the similarity of our one purpose. And that is to hold up God as the one place and source of life. So when you think about praise that way, all of a sudden it becomes very different, right? It really does become about, let's do this together. Let's remember that we're all together as one. And I do think that what we call worship, this praising, I do think that is a time of when we actually feel that unity. Wouldn't you say? I mean, when you're all together and you're actually singing these great hymns, I think that's a time, and I think many of us have felt that time of just almost goosebumps, you know, just this, all of us coming together. But I think that that is more the feeling of the unity of being together, that we're actually all one, that we actually aren't all split up. So remembering that, that's how they begin. And most people believe that when it says that all people gathered as one man, which is the unity thing, that it was spontaneous, that it wasn't actually any of the priests calling them to come, that it was actually spontaneous, that they saw the wall, was finished, and they were all just like, isn't God good? Isn't God good? And telling one another and just coming together as one man.
Yeah, it reminds me of like those Coke commercials where someone's walking down the street.
Yes.
And literally come out of like the
yes.
doorways and join
yes.
the procession.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Right. That's perfect.
Coming out of the woodwork.
Yeah, that's exactly what it is.
Well, and the word, like I'm looking it up, I mean, the word, the root is to give a hand.
Yeah.
So it's like, come
right,
on.
Come on. Yeah. Yeah. Let's come up and let's.
The world would go.
Yeah.
Which word is that to give a hand?
So it's yada.
I mean,
or yalad.
English word.
Gathered
or?
So praise.
Mm-hmm. Oh, praise.
And it's YADAH is the one I looked up. Mm-hmm. the yad means hand, and then the other part is like to give, so it's mm-hmm. to give a hand.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so maybe that's helpful even in our own times of doing that. And I'm becoming more and more aware of using that word worship. And I think that probably for me, the thing I've learned so much in my own classes this semester is that the awe of worship that we don't often bring, that literally on your knees mm-hmm. bowing before, so that the praise is not taken out of it, but that the praise is a gathering together and then coming before Him. So do you have some?
I just see, you know, our services now as like, it's a praise service. Yes. And then when we leave,
yes.
that's the worship.
Yes. Oh. Yes, exactly.
Come on, girl.
But, yeah. But that's true. That's exactly what it is.
Look at her face.
When you think about it that way, in fact, there's a lot of churches used to have above the doors in the inside, yeah. right?
Mm-hmm. The mission field.
Right, things like that. Like, okay, now it's time that we actually go out and we physically manifest our submission to God, mm-hmm. that we're actually going to do everything in our lives as worship.
So it's almost like the whole service is a call to worship.
Yes, yes, exactly. And it's funny because that's how they begin the worship service, mm-hmm. right? The call to worship. Mm-hmm. You think, wow, okay, that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Now, there is a part of our worship services that is delineated as worship, and we'll look at that here as we see that. But because we don't manifest our submission to it, sometimes it becomes more of a what does man have to say rather than what does God have to say. So that's the praise part of it. Then they actually, as you see here, they actually do bow, and so they come to a point of worship as they're attentive, and they come to that point of, I want to put myself in a place that I can hear God's voice, so that I'm submitting to Him in that way. And then they begin to listen. Because, and this is the other part about worship. Worship is always not just submitting to Him, but it's realizing you've been invited into the presence of the King to hear Him. It's not, you've gotten to come in the presence of the King so you can tell Him what you want to tell Him. It's about you hearing Him, not Him hearing you. So it's very much about listening. So if you were to, and I do think we're at a disadvantage not having any relationship to a kingdom, to kings and royalty, that awe of coming there and hearing. I mean, if you've ever watched movies or read stuff about even the English monarchy, that they tell you all sorts of things about when you can go into the queen's presence, what you're to do. And pretty much you shut up until the queen says, now what do you think? And maybe she's not ever going to say that. But that's the idea. When you go into, you know, we have, we've smooshed down the idea of royalty. You know, in the United States, we just think royalty is, you know, not a great thing. But there's this great picture of God being royalty and other and coming in being such a privilege. And I think we've lost that. But that's the worship idea, is this huge privilege mm-hmm. of getting to come into His presence and for him to tell us something, so that we come with this idea of listening. And I almost wish we could go back to that one semester that we spoke about listening, the whole, do you remember mm-hmm. the listening part mm-hmm. and how hard it was for us mm-hmm. to actually listen to one another? And so for those of you who weren't here, we actually got into groups every week, and there were things you had to do to listen to one another. And a couple of them are not thinking about what you're going to say in response, literally just giving them space to talk, somebody else to talk, and you asking them questions from that. But that's the idea, is listening to God's voice. What does He have to say to us? So here's my guess. How many of you have devotions, and the entire devotional time is spent you talking to God? I mean, pretty much, right? How many of us spend our time literally quiet, waiting for Him to talk?
That's so hard.
That's so hard, right?
A lot of time.
Yeah.
I feel like doing yoga has helped me learn the practice of really, like this, like you're talking, this physical posture yes. of setting aside the grocery list and my mm-hmm. schedule for the rest of the day and where I'm headed next. And like, it is amazing how like physically engaging your body can help your mind
yes.
rest.
Yes.
And listen.
Yeah, exactly. So that's kind of, that's actually what it looked like here. This gathering of one man coming together in unity, but then being there in such a posture of this anticipatory listening. Notice how long they stay there. All day long, they stay and listen to what God has to say to them. Last night, our professor read, I don't know, maybe 10 chapters out of Isaiah. A good half hour, he just read. And he said, they would have read Isaiah in one sitting, out loud. And Isaiah is a long book. It's the second longest book, third longest book there is. And of course he talked about how we read it with such a, let's get it done so we can go on to man's comment on what he says. But of course my professor's, that's what he does. And he read it and we were just, like it became alive. And you just, wow, you know, it was beautiful to sit there. But it was a long time. And we're just not used to that. But this is what they did. They really spent their time listening, and they were very anticipatory and very attentive, it says. They just were listening the whole time. And the reason I even want to emphasize some of that is that's the preparation for joy. Without that, you're not going to find the joy that he has for you. Without having all this preparation of being ready to submit myself to listen to him, the joy is not going to be coming. It's going to be coming from that preparation. That's going to be the groundwork for that. And in that groundwork and listening to him, they begin to mourn. So preparation for joy is, first of all, being in that praise together in unity and in that worship mode with both body. And I do think it's interesting. And Robin, I'm glad you brought that up about how our engaging our bodies actually helps us to silence our own voices. This is why worship is always in the Old Testament a very physical bowing down. So we see that. I often wonder, I didn't tell either of you, but during the retreat this weekend, there was a point where I thought, I want to lay on my face here. I want to just, and you know, I'm pulled back. Like, what would that do? You know, if I lay on my face up there, what will that do? It'll make people uncomfortable. You know, this is of course what I'm thinking. But that's what I wanted to do. I do wonder if we did that, would we not have a more easy time of silencing our own stuff? Mm-hmm. You know, if we just got into that position. I would recommend it. And it is an interesting exercise if you ever pray on your face.
Yep. I can't remember who the woman, her name is gone. But she does Bible study, and she has one on Daniel. And when you do the Daniel study with her, you do that every day. With your arms
okay.
up, like a cross on your face.
Okay.
And to me, it's kind of difficult because your face is right on the floor, on the carpet, and you can't hardly breathe or anything. You either put your chin up or your head, you know, your head, forehead down or something, or turn slightly so I can breathe. She's blonde.
Beth Moore.
Yeah. Lots of hair. The interesting thing about that posture, it's the most vulnerable posture. So, I mean, you cannot defend yourself in any way. Which, right. I mean, it's a great posture. I would recommend that you try that, perhaps maybe before Easter comes. So what that brings is when they're literally just listening to God and not their own voice, it brings this sense of mourning. This, wow, like God has been watching me and trying to restore me, and I continue to disconnect. He's been trying to make sure that that connection is strong. That was from the fear of God, of knowing he's there, looking at all those times I'm disconnecting, and him not disconnecting, but bringing me either correction or discipline or whatever I need to get that connection back. And I just keep on like flicking his hand off, like, go away, go away. And that brings this sense of loss. Like all these times that I could have been full. And I just flicked him away as if he were a fly. And that brings for them this sense of overwhelming loss. What have I lost for all those times? All those times when I could have been whole and full, and I have let that go. So this morning brings into focus the times I have disconnected. And what we're going to see here is it actually becomes a cycle of seeing his disconnection and my disconnection, and seeing that. So this is beginning to see that as that becomes part of joy. And then out of that, having this hunger, and every single person that ever writes about this part of Nehemiah talks about this literal hunger, because after this time, they want to come back for more, and they want to come back for more and more, and they just want to hear what God has to say. So that out of the mourning is this hunger of, no, I want to be connected, and not only that, I want those times of him correcting me and disciplining me when I'm not connected. Oh, I so want those. So that what you see in mourning is your own paradigm begins to change. Your paradigm of saying, oh, I don't want to be disciplined. Oh, no, don't do that. To, please, bring me the discipline. Bring me that, because I see what I'm missing, and I don't want to miss that. This is the one time that fear of missing out is actually a good thing. It's this, I don't want to miss out on the connection and the wholeness that I could be with him. So it's this understanding of what a right relationship looks like, and a hunger for that, and a hunger for his action in my life to do that. So that I have a hunger constantly for what he has to say to me. So we have here in the beginning of Nehemiah 8 is this idea of preparing for joy, of worshiping and praising and listening and mourning the losses of connection, so that it changes my paradigm to want whatever God needs to bring me for restoration, no matter what it is, that I actually long for it. I don't know how many of you have ever been in a situation where somebody you loved was so far away from God, was so walking away, that you got to the point where you prayed for whatever it took. Mm-hmm. This is the same thing happening, but for yourself. It's, Lord, whatever it takes, any time that I'm straying, whatever it takes, I want that. So you know the depth it took for you to pray a prayer like that for someone you love? Mm-hmm. It's that. It actually brings you to this depth that you want that. But then Nehemiah says to them, but be cautious, because that is a momentary thing. That cannot be. We cannot be. There was a time when it was very popular to flagellate yourself, right? So it was a constant, I am a worm, oh, worm am I. And they would actually literally beat themselves with ropes with things that had sharp things on them.
Do
they still do that? Okay, so there's still that idea. And Nehemiah says, no, that's not. The point of that is to bring you to desire the connection. And when you do that, then you let it go. Because if I continue to do that, my focus remains on me. Mm-hmm. It's always about what I have done, how horrible I am, how terrible I am. And the whole point of it is to bring you back to God, so that you focus on who God is and what he has done. So that it must be momentary. And he really says, he really desires it to be there, but to be very momentary. So that you get to the place, I want the connection, and now see, what has God been doing, and what is God going to continue to do to keep that connection for me? So that the focus needs to change. So that I become aware, and to realize also, that my awareness of my sin and my disconnection has actually been a gift. That I didn't make it possible for me to be aware. He made it possible. So that all of a sudden I begin to think, wow, even my mourning was a gift he gave me so that I could come back and desire that connection even more. And I return to focusing on him and his grace and what he is doing. So the end of preparing for joy is to put away your grief, to actually emotionally reset your heart so that you have room for wholeness. And he says here, Nehemiah says, mourn no more because it's a holy day. It's a day for putting you back together. It's a day for reminding you that reconnection is making you holy. So that's what he means when he talks about put away your grief, for it's a holy day. So that's preparing for joy. We're never going to get to joy without that preparation. So we need to remember that that's essential for us to get there. But then I want to talk about embracing joy. And he only talks about this once. Of course, it's the one verse that we take out of Nehemiah, right? The joy of the Lord is my strength. So we take that out of there without, you know, actually knowing anything else. So I kind of want to expand that a little bit about what it looks like to embrace the joy that you're talking about there. And then at the very end of the lesson, we'll talk about the flip side of it. But I want to show you a clip so that you begin to understand what we're seeing in joy. Because joy, we're actually exploring the spectrum of grace, of all the things that God has done to maintain that connection with us, all of the gifts that he's given us, so that we begin to understand that everything has been this huge gift so that connection is maintained and strengthened. And we don't see that without understanding all God has gone through to give us that grace. So the clip is from a movie, and I meant to tell you, Pat, about this beforehand, so I apologize. The movie's about Alzheimer's, so you're going to see some of the things that you kind of have gone through. And it's what this husband does as his wife develops early set on Alzheimer's. It's not still Alice. And to me, every time I read through Nehemiah, all I could think of was this movie of this man's faithfulness to his wife as she gets lost in that. So I'm going to show, that's going to be the first clip, and the second clip will be a little glimmer of her back again. I apologize. There's one profanity in there. I apologize. I can't figure out how to get it out of there. But I think the clip is, to me, so indicative of what it looks like for God as we're disconnecting from him, which is what happens in Alzheimer's, right? They start to disconnect. So let's see if we can bring this up here. Has anybody seen this away from her? It's a beautiful and very, very tough movie.
I was even thinking of The Notebook.
Did think about The Notebook. Sorry, advertisement always first.
All 12 American heroes were killed.
People are saying mom's alive. Why don't you believe them?
Such a fun place to visit.
Fucking depressing. No offense.
None taken.
No one came to visit you, huh? That must suck huge.
Well, it would suck huge, but I don't live here. I'm just visiting someone.
Who? Oh, which one?
Beautiful woman with the shock of hair.
The one sitting with her husband?
You might say that.
Why wouldn't you?
I wouldn't say that because I'm her husband.
So why aren't you sitting with her then?
Just learn to give her some space. She's in love with that man she's sitting with. I don't like to disturb her. Just like to see her, I suppose. Make sure she's doing well, you know? I suppose I must seem rather pathetic.
I should be so lucky.
I mean, I think you obviously know what's going on. I mean, he's a lot. I love that he said, I'm just giving her space. So the man that she is having dinner with, his name is Aubrey, and that will just help you understand this little piece here. So this is a little bit later that she actually has a glimmer of coming back.
Valuable books lying around. People who stay here aren't all necessarily honest. I think they got the clothes mixed up. I never wear yellow. I seem to remember you reading this to me. You were trying to make me feel better. You tried so hard. You're a lovely man, you know. I'm a very lucky woman.
Fiona?
You've been gone a long time. Are we all checked out?
I have a surprise for you. Do you remember Aubrey?
They exiled me. Just driven away without a care in the world, and forsaken me.
Not a chance.
So you notice that if you watch the whole, I mean, you'll just cry the whole time. Here's this man who every day visits her and watches her separate from him. And yet he gives her space. And then she has these glimmers of coming back, and she realizes, when he mentions Aubrey, she knows that there's this, I've separated at some point. And she doesn't want to deal with it, but she knows that this man has never forsaken her. Mm. And I thought about this movie, and then when I watched those, I realized these are the exact words in here. Mm-hmm. God does never forsake. And yet he sits there the whole time. He watches us separate. Mm-hmm. And it just, to me, that is that picture of understanding the amount of grace that he gives us every day. the times that he's sitting on the couch watching us separate from him. And he just waits, and he just waits. And when we come back to him, he doesn't say, what have you been doing? Why have you? He just says, I'll never forsake you. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's, to me, that is what joy is about, is seeing the grace that God gives us every day. And this huge patience that he has with us, and the space he gives us, and then for him to just receive us back. That's the idea behind joy, actually, is understanding that depth of grace that he has for us. So when we look and explore the spectrum of grace, those are the kind of things that Nehemiah is calling us to, is to overlay the word of God in our lives and see that he's been sitting on the couch the whole time, watching us be so tender with our idols, and then receiving us back. So the grace, first of all, to recognize is the grace of his presence. Like that man, he never missed a day. Every day he came and watched his beautiful wife that he loved separating from him over and over again. God's grace of his presence is that he doesn't leave us alone. And I think I always want to go back to Genesis 3, where we have this erroneous picture of God saying, get out of the garden, get out of my presence. When we know for a fact is that what God did is started chasing us. And he just kept following us. And he stayed there. And he remains there. And this presence is the biggest grace gift we will ever receive, is that he keeps on chasing us and following us. The grace of discipline, where he actually brings us warning that we're separating. And if you watch this whole movie, I mean, this is just like the whole thing. This is exactly what happens. You're separating from me. No, I'm not, you know. There's a clip I almost showed you that he's saying, I'm your husband. And she's saying, don't say that to me. Don't say that to me. But the discipline that God gives us so that we don't separate is a huge grace. Because he wants to make sure that we're embracing where our life is, where our worth is found, where who we are and our purpose is, so that he's doing us this big favor in disciplining us. And for those of us who've had to discipline harshly someone, it's not a joy, is it? It's not fun to have to discipline someone. But we do it out of love. I mean, sometimes we do it out of anger, and that's not the kind of discipline God does, but out of this deep love of us not connecting. So for us to embrace joy, it means to embrace the fact that his discipline of us is this great desire for us to have joy in connection. There's also the grace of the awareness of discipline. So a lot of times we'll be disciplined and we don't even have the awareness that we're being disciplined. But that all of a sudden when we realize, oh, I know what this is, that's a grace. That is a gift that God gives us to recognize this is restoration here. He's reconnecting us. That is a gift that we need to be aware of. That it's actually his tending to us. A couple weekends ago we went bowling, and next to us the lane had, I never even knew this, because you know when we were kids, if you had bumper pads, they were big blow-up things that they had to go put down. Now, so did anybody bowl? They raise up out of the ground. So if whoever's bowling, if they need bumper pads, up they come. Here are the bumper pads, and the next person doesn't need them, they go down. Yeah, it's really cool. That's exactly what happens for us. God raises up those bumper pads sometime, just to make sure that we don't go in the gutter. And those things of discipline, if we can think about them as bumper pads, oh, those are great. They keep us in the lane there. But then the grace of emotional vulnerability. And this is this point where he allows us sometimes to go so deep and so hard and so, like, in the most intensely hurting places, those are gifts. Those are graces. For us to be able to mourn the loss there. We need that mourning, and that is a grace for him to bring us to a place where we're emotionally spent, that we can no longer fight against that connection anymore. Because remember last week, I think we talked about, oh no, I guess that was the retreat. We talked about the idea that when those who oppose us, they're actually opposing themselves, they're fighting who they really are. When we get to those places that are so hard for us, it's like we let it go. Like, it's, I'm not going to oppose myself anymore. I can't. I have no energy to do it. That's a gift for us to be in those places that are just so hard. And so to embrace joy, what you start to begin to see is embracing everything. And we've talked about this a lot, but I think this goes deeper. This embracing everything as a gift, to literally see that the gift is him reconnecting us, never allowing us to go too far. He will if we keep pulling at it. But if we see it as a gift of him saying, come back to who you are, come back to where your life is, we can see that as a great gift, and we will come back. And the last one is the grace of the clean welcome, which is that end scene where she says, and I love that she says it three times different ways, you could have forsook me. You could have forsaken me. And then she just says, forsaken. And it's, I mean, that's all she needs to say. And he says, never, never. He has no recrimination for her. He doesn't say, so now can we get over this Aubrey guy? Can we do, you know, it's this, I will never forsake you. It's this clean welcome back. It's, I'm so glad you're back. Because it's your wholeness that I've wanted all along. It's your life that I've wanted all along for you. And, you know, I thought about this as when we give people that we love space. And I really struggled with this week, is when we give them the space and they take it and run with it, and you're just mourning, the way to get them back isn't to remind them of how much you're hurting. He never does that. He never lets on to her that she's hurting. And I feel like that's a beautiful picture of God. He never keeps saying, do you know how much you're breaking my heart? You know, cry, you know, coming to us and crying and doing all sorts of things. When we come back saying, do you know how much you've hurt me? He just receives us back. And to me, that is that last point of, what kind of a God do we have that can hold all that pain and not put it on us, and that we can come back and have this welcome back? That is embracing what joy looks like. So that joy, although it ends up being emotional, it isn't this emotion coming from things are great. It's this deep understanding. And this is why he uses the word understanding so many times. It's this deep understanding of the awesomeness of a God who graces us and graces us and graces us and welcomes us back and never says, I've been in so much pain while you've been doing this. That is the joy that he's talking about. That's where it becomes so deep. I think sometimes we have done the idea of joy a disservice. I was trying to think about what songs did we learn about joy, you know, when we were kids. Joy, joy, yes. But think about what it says. I'm so happy, so very happy. That's not what it is. That's not what joy is. Joy is understanding the extent of grace and being so grateful that the grace is bigger than we have ever imagined. And being able to understand the joy means to be able to go into those dark places, those deep places, those places where we mourn the disconnection. Joy has got to come out of the mourning of the disconnection. If we've never kind of gone into those places of understanding how we've disconnected, we won't have joy. Because joy comes out of God's continual reconnection and continual efforts over and over again to keep us connected. It's that picture of the prodigal son. It's that father giving the prodigal son everything and giving him space, right? He gives him space, he lets him run away, and when the son comes back, what's the father's reaction? Open arms, right? And what's he want to do with him? Right, exactly. Let's celebrate together. He never brings out the, so let's see what you did with all the money. Let's see what you did with all the time. It's just this huge grace party. This is the picture that Nehemiah is showing, and he will show them over and over again. Do you have any idea the grace that is involved in your daily life? And so he's going to bring them in a cycle of remembering over and over and over again the amount of grace. For them, they had to have begun to start thinking about the events since they've been back in Judah. The fact that they got back to Judah not because they had actually turned around in Babylon. I'm just reading in Jeremiah right now, and Jeremiah keeps saying, you're going to go to Babylon, and in Babylon, you're not going to turn back to him either. And yet God's going to bring you back. So right from that very beginning, to think, how have we gotten back into God's connection? For this last clip, how did she get back there? Because he didn't leave her. He stayed right there. And when she came, had that one glimmer, he was right there. So that for them to think about that God had brought them back. And then to think through the whole thing that we've gone through is they came back, they started the temple, and then they started thinking they were missing out on getting their own stuff done, right? And so they start building their own stuff. And God doesn't leave, and he stays there. And he waits 14 years. They're building their own luxurious paneled houses over and over again.
So that kind of gives me a new spin on our memory verse, because I hear, consider how that, you know, I hear today's words like, yeah, how's that going for you? That's not what God's saying.
Right, exactly. I mean, it's this, I'm here.
Yeah. It comes at it from...
Right, exactly. It comes at it from a very different place. And so they can think about that. And they think about the fact that he brought them back with Haggai, right? He brings... And so all of a sudden they begin to think, oh, prophets? And let's get really real here. Prophets were not liked because prophets always warn. Prophets always warn. And so prophets are always going, you're not where you should be. You're not whole. And now they get to look and go, wow, I'm so glad God sent Haggai, that he would bring us back, that he would tell us, you're building your own houses and you're not building the temple. So they could think about that. And they could think about actually God's grace in allowing them to hear that and to see that they had not been doing it. And so they get to the business of doing it. And they build a temple. And they finish the temple, and it ends at the 7-year mark. And they see again, all through history, God has been there, planning and waiting for the reconnection, and saying, I'm going to bring you back to the reconnection. All the way to, now they're going to build the walls. And they stop again, because they are afraid of man. And they see now this lens of, and there was God, standing there, sitting on the couch, waiting, as we stop building the walls, because we're afraid of man. And we start doing other things. And of course, they see Nehemiah come. God's graces of bringing Nehemiah, bringing more Jews from Babylon to come to help out. They see Nehemiah's call to them, that Nehemiah is not afraid of the men. And he says, we've got a great work here to do. Let's join together, this kind of call to come together. So they begin to review in their minds what has been happening all of these years that they have been in the land, and there God has remained every single step of the way, when they're connected and when they're disconnected, all of those times. So that it becomes for them this deeper awareness of their proclivity to disconnect. That they're, what's the There's a him.
Prone to wander?
Yes, that's exactly. Yes, I know that I'm prone to wander. And that's what's happening here, is they're beginning to understand who they are. They are people who are very prone to wander, as we are. We're so prone to wander. Just like the woman here. She's so prone to losing it that these moments of understanding that that's who she is, but that there's one constant for her, and that being her husband. And in us understanding our proclivity of disconnection, to understand his faithfulness, there comes the gratitude that comes out as joy. This is where joy actually is from, coming from understanding all of our disconnections and all of our constantly disconnecting and him remaining faithful right there and having to do whatever it takes for him to stay there, for him to be there when we turn. So that is the embracing joy of really thinking about all of the graces that he has poured out in our life. Knowing that all of those graces, the essential thing is his presence, all there. With the clip of the first thing, he never even talks to her at that point. He's just there. His presence is there, waiting and waiting and still loving her. And interesting that I like that it has the scene with the young girl, because she gets to see, wow, I could be so lucky to have someone waiting for me all the time in the midst of my rebellion. That's what she would hope for, because it's what we all hope for. And that's where the joy comes, is we have someone who does that every day of our lives. So that's the embracing joy, to understand the grace of each of those pieces. And then there's the making space for joy as we go into the rest of chapter 8. And we have this, put away grief and now celebrate. And the words actually there are keep the feast, which to me is very, very special. And I know none of you have done this, but in the Anglican Church, when we have communion and we go through the communion of this is what Christ has done for you, and he holds up the host and he says, here's his body broken for you, this is what he's done. And the whole congregation always says, therefore, let us keep the feast. Therefore, we mourn that disconnection, yet the connection has been continued with him. Therefore, let us celebrate. Let us continue to celebrate. Let us keep the feast. It's this, okay, let's not just say, oh, that was nice, and go on. Let's keep the feast. Let's keep on celebrating and enjoying that. This is a point where Nehemiah tells the people, I want you to physically engage in this. And that goes back to you're talking about when our bodies physically engage. He literally wants them to engage in the celebration, not just to say, oh, that is great, but to physically engage in it in three different ways. He wants us to participate in the bounty. So he wants us, I love that he goes, go, eat, taste, eat everything that is there. Remember that this celebration is the celebration of Sukkoth, or the Feast of Booths. And this is the harvest time. So this is the fall harvest, their biggest harvest. And he wants them to eat it. Not, oh, look at all the harvest, let's hoard it. But I want you to eat it. I literally want you to taste my goodness. Taste what I have provided. And in tasting it, I also want you to share it. I want you to give it out to anyone who doesn't have any. You go and give it out so that it becomes literally a piece of your body, that you eat it and that you share it, that it isn't just for you. But then he says, and with the bounty, I also want you to build a show of the bounty. I want you to be able to see this bounty for the next week. I want you to look and see how much I've provided for you. Even when you were in the desert, that place that you thought was scarcity, I provided for you. I gave you. And so go and build these booths and live in them. And I love that he delineates all the kind of branches. Did you notice the branches that you need to go? First get the olive branch, right? But then what? The wild olive branch. that talks about the Gentiles. Mm. When we talk about coming in. Mm-hmm. So it's this, I have a bounty for you. It's going to be all the nations. But, I mean, this is just this hint underneath here. But he's saying, I have a bounty that everything is there for you. And I want you to build it and show yourselves all the bounty I've given you, all the grace that I have afforded you over and over, that I've poured it down on you, and you've been living in my grace. Now I want you to physically live inside of these grace booths. I want you to physically put your body into that place where you have heard with your head and your heart that I've given you grace. Now I want you to actually participate in that. I actually want you to physically do that. And you know, I wonder, what does that look like for us? Mm-hmm. Here's an interesting thing. Sukkoth is actually what the pilgrims modeled Thanksgiving after. So they actually looked at Sukkoth and they had a bounty after a whole year of going through devastating stuff. They crossed, you know, just like the Jews crossed the desert, they crossed the sea, they lost a lot of people, they had diseases, they had lots of things happening. And yet comes this fall time, and they actually have a bounty. And they are so thrilled. And so they look at Sukkoth, and they model Thanksgiving after Sukkoth. So it'd be interesting if we think about that when we celebrate Thanksgiving, that that's actually a celebration of Sukkoth, of physically reminding ourselves that we've been living in God's grace all this time. Wouldn't that be fun to make our own booths at Thanksgiving?
To be a little chilly.
It'd be a little chilly, but we could do them inside. But yeah, wouldn't
Harvest
it be cool?
Is really October.
Harvest is really October, and Thanksgiving was not for the pilgrims as late as it is here. Remember that was a 19th century declaration. Let's do the third Thursday in Thanksgiving or of November. Yeah, we could do it. And actually, I told you this Sukkoth coming up. I want to take a field trip to Skokie, where they actually have them. From what Jamie has told us, wouldn't that be cool? They actually build their huts all over the place. And Jamie told us that she said she went to like Starbucks and there was a little hut sitting outside Starbucks. So places that are have a lot of Orthodox Jews actually have these huts. I think that'd be so cool. So please remind me, next Sukkoth, this October, we're going to go to Skokie. Mm-hmm. Even if it's on a Wednesday, we're going to go there and then we're going to build our own. So I think that would be a great idea to remember that we have lived in his grace all this time. I mean, what a beautiful picture. We have lived in his grace all of this time. And we need to remember it, but we also need to proclaim it to the generations. We live in his grace. That's what those booths were about. We live in his grace. The interesting thing about Sukkoth is that Sukkoth was the one festival that had the most sacrifices. Isn't that interesting? Had the most sacrifices of all, including a Day of Atonement. So Sukkoth is this, God has given us so much. We will give up everything to celebrate living in the grace of God rather than in our own little deserts. They began to call it the Day of Our Rejoicing. It's the only feast that is actually prescribed that you must rejoice. So there's actually a commandment to rejoice in Sukkoth, which tells you it's not an emotion. So there is this commandment to rejoice. So we need to remind ourselves we've been living in his grace all this time and to proclaim it to the generations to come and to recognize the contrast. His grace has come in the midst of our unfaithfulness. We continue to be unfaithful and he continues to be faithful. And we come back to him, and he's still faithful. So that in making the booths was actually physically making space for God to flourish in our lives. To allow his grace to flourish and to recognize that his presence is our flourishing ourselves and our joy. That is making space for joy. Is celebrating, really taking it in. So I think in the next week that we have off, I think that our challenge is to come up with ideas of how do we participate in the celebration of his grace? Literally, how do we taste it? How do we walk in it? How do we build it? How are some ways you in your life could actually physically participate in making space for joy. It has to be physical. It cannot be. We tend to think of things like joy as residing only in our heart, right? Only an emotional idea. And it's more than that. We saw with thinking through grace, it had to be in the mind, and feeling the mourning, it had to be in the heart. But it has to also be in our body. We actually have to walk in joy and choose to do that. So he talks about celebrating the feast, but then to also, because from the feast, they wait about two and a half weeks, 3 weeks, to go into a time of fasting. And what this made me think about is that, and they don't talk about this, but the Day of Atonement has been about a month before this. So they've had that. They come to this celebration. And then 2 or 3 weeks later, they come to another time of fasting and making space for him. To make space for God takes a lot of time. And Rebecca, I love what you said. And I am going to share that. Or you can share that, maybe even better. That Rebecca talked about what it's been doing in her family to name worth. And that, I love you said, our days have slowed to a crawl. And I thought, that's exactly it. If we're to live like this, if we're actually to find joy, our days have got to be decluttered. We cannot find that joy. If it takes this, it's going to be having our days slow to a crawl. And I kept thinking about that over and over again. Last night as I'm laying in bed, I thought, boy, if this is what it is, our lives are so full of stuff. We can't put this in the lives that we have. And remember when we had all the books on the table and the making space? Some of those books have got to go. And we have to bring ourselves to a place where our lives are not so full. And I do think that's a challenge. So I guess that's my challenge to you in the week that we have off is, in bringing joy into our lives, what are we taking out? And is it worth it? Is joy worth taking out being busy, being so active? Because physically we need to step into joy. We're not going to be physically able to do all the other things that we do. So he says, continue to make space. Fast and fill with God's word. So fast from all the other things. Fasting, first of all, he says, separate from foreigners. And what he means there is to separate from the foreign ways, to separate from, to be free of their messages. Remember last week we talked about their messages are everywhere. But to be free from their messages. So separate, there have to be times that you actually separate from their messages altogether, which all of a sudden gives you an idea of what Sabbath is, right? Sabbath is actually pulling away from the messages of the world. So that's part of Sabbath. Actually pulling away from the messages of the world. And then being able to come to confession. To be able to say, I have disconnected many times this week. Many times this week. Boy, you know, I think confession is one of those things that we skip over a lot. Confession for Hebrews was public. It was not a private thing. We don't like that, do we? We tend to even look at the Catholic Church who still does it and say, oh, why would you do that? Now, I understand because there's been some corruption in that. And yet, the practice of, James says it, the New Testament says, confess your sins one to another. So that since we are all priests, that's where the confession comes, that we actually confess to one another. And which is what they do here. For them, confession, literally, they went to the public square and they would say, this is what I've done, within the unity. But remember, if you come in praise and you've all been unified, you're all confessing. So it's not like I'm confessing and the rest of you are just great. We're all confessing here.
Well, and it became clear that it didn't take long for it to turn into more of a practice of, I'm going to take you to confession.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right,
I mean,
exactly.
That's what Jesus was encountering.
Exactly, right.
Like,
forced confession.
Right, of, exactly. Like,
I'm yeah. gonna, you know,
yeah.
make you say your stuff.
Yeah. So we have this confession and worship, and then again, listening. And we notice that worship always comes and then listening, because that's what worship is. Bowing yourself, ready to hear what God has to say, and then listening. And so then again, they listen for another quarter of the day to the book of the law read, remembering that they haven't really heard this. In Babylon is when they began to start writing down most of the law, most of the Pentateuch. That was being done, though, in these newly formed synagogues, where the rabbis were doing all of this, where the priests were doing this. And yet, it doesn't seem like it was becoming too... it certainly wasn't common for them to hear that. This is most likely the first time that they have actually heard whole sections of their scripture read out loud to people. And remember, they are a listening culture. We're not a listening culture. We're a visual culture. Mm-hmm. But they're a listening culture, and they're just in awe and also in this, wow, we have not lived like that. And we have never even noticed that he's been on the couch that whole time. So they listen quite a bit. And I love, and I think for us, our listening needs to be speaking it. And I don't think we do this very often. This is what our professor had. Our professor has us reading. So this whole semester is on the prophets and the wisdom books. We're reading it out loud. All of the prophets, all of the wisdom books. That's part of our homework, is to read it out loud. So every morning I'm reading out loud Jeremiah and Isaiah. And it becomes very different when you read it out loud. You hear things that you never saw before, you never heard before. So for us, the hearing needs to be speaking of God's faithfulness, speaking scripture, speaking what he has been saying to us, so that we actually hear it. It's so easy to read scripture passage in our head. Mm-hmm. And we go away, and I bet somebody could ask you, so what did you just read? And most of the time your answer would be, I think I was reading Jeremiah. You know, it's just this, like, but you read it out loud, which we don't do anymore, and it becomes actually real. Like, oh, these were actually real people, and these are real events, and you start to connect a little bit more.
Even in church, I can remember as a child, the church I went to there used to have a reading from the Old Testament and a reading from the New Testament in every service. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't long, but it wasn't just a verse. But nowadays, it's usually just one or two verses, and then they preach the whole sermon on
right
one or two verses.
Yeah, which is, now in the Anglican church, we still do that. So we, and it is a, that's part of the procession, is you bring the Bible out into the congregation. Everyone stands for it. You read the Old Testament scripture. You read the New Testament scripture. And you actually hear it. Sometimes someone will actually have memorized it and read it. And it's really lovely and beautiful. You guys probably do in some of your services, right?
We have one pastor
memorizes. Yeah, I mean, and isn't it, you're just...
in awe.
Oh, it's so beautiful. It's so beautiful. Remember, a couple weeks ago, the question was the team that you most liked being on? And I had said the team I liked most being on was a drama team. And it was actually a whole Easter service. It was just the book of Mark, maybe. Literally, three of us actors, the book of Mark, acting and saying the whole thing. It was just memorized, the whole thing. And it was like, you don't need man's words. God has great words. Beautiful, absolutely beautiful. So this is really what he's calling us to, for us to be able to bring it into our culture, for us to actually speak God's faithfulness, so that we begin to speak what he has done. And this is what Nehemiah does. The priests start reading to the congregation there, to all of the Jews there, about how God has been tending them. How he's been naming them and tending them and making space for them. And he goes through this whole list of, he promised to tend you, he rescued you. And there's this beautiful litany of the whole history of their nation, the entire history. And they hear again what God has done. Mm-hmm. And it's this, God's been here, he's tended you, he's pursued you, he's rescued you, he's provided for you, he's instructed you, and you turned away. And you did this. And now God has gone back. So I have a list here under speaking God's faithfulness on page 3 and 4. What I'd like you to do, I want you to just start this because it will take forever, but I want you to think about this. As we put down these list of things that God has done for Israel, he's done for us too. So I want you to take every one of those. Just start under God's actions of tending, the promise to tend, rescuing, leading, instruction, provisions. I want you to take, and I'm going to give you some time, to write down one thing you can think of in your life where God has actually rescued you, a time that God has rescued you, a time that God has led you, a time that God has instructed you, a time that God has provided for you. You're the only one who's going to see this, but I want you to write those down. And we'll continue to go through. And then I want you to write down your response to any tending, any time you turned away from him, any time you refused to listen to him, that you didn't remember, that you desired the world, Egypt instead, or that you blasphemed. Just come up with one solid example for each of those so that you begin to participate in this grace, that you literally see that he's been doing this. And you've done exactly what Israel's done as well. So go ahead. I'm going to give you a good maybe 10 minutes to do that. Okay.
Jill, I kind of had this like revelation while we were doing this. Because when I was looking at that word confess, it turned out to be the same word that came up for praise.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It turned out to be the same word that came up for thanks.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
And it was that yada word. And I just started thinking about the way we've traditionally done confession and how it has been like a flagellation. It has been like, I was so bad. Oh my gosh, I did this and I thought this and I, you know what I mean, said this and we really do this. I was like, but if confession is the same word as thanks, it's the same word as praise, mm-hmm. it's the same word as recounting, like, what if I shifted my confession to not be about me,
mm-hmm.
but to be about what God was doing there?
Yes.
You know what I mean? So, like, oh my goodness, I was talking, like, I had this with a friend this morning. We were talking about naming worth, and she's like, oh my goodness, I had this moment yesterday. I said something really mean to someone by text, and I was, I realized it wasn't naming worth. And I was able to, like, go back and go, oh, oops, sorry, you know? And, like, to me, that's, like, God was doing something
there. Right,
versus,
exactly.
like, flagellation,
yes.
you know what I mean?
Yes.
Or even in the midst of, like, sin, to be like, God must be doing something here.
Yes.
Versus, I'm horrible.
Yes.
You know what I mean?
Yes.
I don't know. Like, the fact that those are all the same word just makes mm-hmm. me think, have mm-hmm. we just mm-hmm. done with confession, what we've done with the gospel? It's all about
right.
me. And it starts and ends with me, my salvation, my horribleness, my sinfulness.
Well, mm-hmm. and it goes back to what we talked about last mm-hmm. week of fear of man versus fear of
yes.
God.
Yes.
Right.
Like, we're scared of confession because we're scared of what someone
right.
else is going to how they're going to identify,
right.
not
right.
what God's doing.
Right, right. exactly.
Right.
Exactly, which is
yeah.
really cool. Do you remember at New Song when we did a public confession of
yeah.
on the walls?
Yeah.
It really was very powerful because it was, look what God's doing in the midst of us. And
yeah.
literally, we plastered the entire walls of the sanctuary with all of our confessions. And they were... There's some tough stuff out there, just tough. And to see that God, like, here it is, and God's doing something with this.
Mm-hmm.
It's about the greatness of our God and what he can do. And that's why this is embedded in joy,
mm-hmm.
rather than the idea of, what have I done?
Well, the joy moment in that was that was done on Good Friday,
right.
and on Easter morning, the service started with the tearing of all the sheets
yes.
all around.
Yeah,
and that was like, whoa.
Yeah, like
that's gone. Like that's
wow.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But I feel like we've talked about it before, about it being more about agreeing with God
yes.
about something,
right.
telling the truth about something, and you're just in unity.
In unity,
agreement
yes.
that it's
yeah.
bad, and I think about when we do it publicly too, and just to use Sherilyn's story about the drive-through, she becomes vulnerable, and then she's approachable, and I can go to Sherilyn and say, oh, "Let me tell you what I did."
yes.
Instead of
yes.
hiding what we've done.
Yes.
But
exactly.
what if the agreement isn't that that's bad? What if the agreement is that God is doing something, even in the midst of me screwing
yeah.
up?
Yes.
Do you know what I'm
yeah.
saying? Like, what if I have been wrong about what I'm agreeing to? Like, how, like, if I'm just sitting there agreeing, I'm horrible, or, oh my gosh, I'm horrible and God's doing something
right,
with it.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I think that was what the last scene was, and that's what I wanted to show you is, she had that, I have been going after somebody else. But it did, what was the whole thing about it? You remain faithful. You're not forsaking me. You're doing this. So, and that's exactly why Nehemiah says, the mourning has got to flip. It's got to flip to, what has God been doing with this? How cool. I mean, it's just, it's an amazing, it's almost that God gives us this opportunity to actually flip the paradigms. Like literally sit in there and flip with that paradigm. So that it isn't about you anymore. That it becomes about God, which is what our life is, right?
And what Nehemiah does.
And
right?
What Nehemiah does. Listing. Yeah, exactly.
This has been about God.
This has been about God the whole time. I mean, it's just God did this, God did this. And if you start doing keywords, it's in God. I gave, I provided. You're just like, amazing. Absolutely amazing. And all of that was on top of anything they did. It just came on top. So my challenge to you is actually continue to take this list, because these are things we need to actually say to ourselves. We actually need to speak these. We actually need to hear that God has been doing things over and above where we've been, over and above our disconnections. God's been connecting, that all of these things are there. And that's why, again, I would say it's really helpful to have something physical. Every once in a while, I take my little piggy and I just hold him and just kind of like think through, like I want to physically know, and it'll make me start crying. God is restoring me. Yeah, I've been just like a pig, and I have, but God's in my pigginess. God's restoring me, and I just think.
When he loves pigs.
And he loves pigs, and he said they're clean. I mean, you know, just like. So, what?
Praise God for
babies. That's right, exactly. Yes. So for us to speak the contrast is to see that God's faithfulness covers our unfaithfulness. So it's not this, I'm unfaithful, God's faithful. It's, I'm unfaithful, God's faithful. God's faithful. It just covers all of that unfaithfulness. And that should begin to make you understand where joy comes from. So it's, because if it's this, there's no joy about it. My unfaithfulness still stands out here as wretched and ugly. But when it's this, I don't see that unfaithfulness. I don't see that little piggy as unclean anymore.
You know
I just
what?
Keep
it
seeing
it. It reminds
that.
Me of that other word we talked about that also means bowing, and that was barak, blessing.
Mm-hmm.
So it like reminds me of like the cycle of like, yes. Wow, when we bow down and worship, like God pours down blessing.
Right.
Like the whole like posture of blessing and worship, blessing and worship, and how that kind of creates joy in a way.
Exactly. And that's
they're
what
both that same posture.
They're both the same posture. And that's what you should be seeing. And that's what I kept seeing in Nehemiah 8 through 10. It's this constant cycle of yes, this, but this. Mm-hmm. Yes, this, but this. And it just keeps going. This covering over, so that you can do nothing but have joy over that. So the question becomes, if I'm struggling with joy, am I not seeing the covering over? Am I seeing this? Am I not seeing the constant faithfulness, the constant sitting on the couch, giving me space, and making sure that when I come back, it's this. It's this.
Reminds me of that Francis Schaeffer thing we read a long time ago, where he started doing that thing where you talk about concrete, he started writing down things that he was like guilty of all day, right?
Mm-hmm.
So he's like, oh, it's just, and he would write them down on a piece of paper or whatever. And then at the end of the day, he would just tear them or burn them, depending on like what situation he was in. And he would just be like, wow,
this is
amazing.
Yeah.
God
right.
is dealing with
right.
all of these
them.
Things,
yeah.
you know?
All the time.
And he just physically was like, I will physically look at what God is doing.
Yes. Yes. And again, remember I said, let's come up with something for yourself. How do you physically not only participate in the celebration, but physically celebrate in what came, how the celebration came out of that He just keeps on tearing it up over and over again. I think we did that one time with, didn't we? We actually burned stuff in here, right? Mm-hmm. We had them all, I had you do that, write all those things, and then physically burn them. So that when we see that we've used God's good to try to build ourselves our own little things, and yet God keeps on using our own little things to build into us connection again. But he does say, Nehemiah says, because of that, we continue to be ruled over instead of rulers. So that we have to get out of that cycle and allow that grace to be what we live in. Allow that joy. So that the last thing they do, after he goes through the whole list of all the grace that God has continued to cover over them over and over and over again, he then says, so then we all wrote our names on this commitment. And what they're doing is making their own covenant. Is they actually write a covenant to God that says, not only are we going to separate ourselves from that disconnection, we're going to separate ourselves to your instructions. And what he wants us to see here is that from all of that, our paradigm of looking at what the law is, we begin to see the law as grace as well. We see that as being the vehicle that God uses to help us maintain connection. To help us maintain connection with him, but also with each other. So that we begin to, as they choose to separate to the law, it's this physical, I'm going to write my name down and say, I am no longer going to live under the paradigm of transactions. I'm no longer going to live under the paradigm of me getting my stuff done, me being independent. But I'm going to live under that paradigm of God transforming me and making my connection stronger and stronger and stronger as I live under that, so that I see his instructions as grace. And so we think about covenant and what that means, knowing that it is a commitment. And, you know, we go through the whole course of covenant again, realizing how serious that is, how serious of a commitment that is. But the commitment there always is a commitment. Remember what covenant, what's this ceremony that you go through in a covenant?
Walking through the
road. Right, yeah. Which is, what is that asking for?
Death.
Right. If I break covenant, may I die. So covenant is always, first of all, asking for the discipline I need in order to stay connected. Please. But do you see what it's taken to get there? All of this, understanding what God has done, the mourning, the leaving off mourning, the celebrating, so that I come to a place where it actually becomes natural for me to say, God, would you discipline me when I'm disconnecting? I want you to discipline me. And literally a desire for that comes out of all this, so that there's joy in saying, God, keep me accountable. And even within our own community, we ask each other to keep us accountable. Would you remind me of that? When I'm doing that, would you remind me? Would you stop and say, I'm going to show you what it looks like from here. So that we request discipline. But there's this commitment also to fully follow God. 100% God, you're in charge. I just saw a new program called The Prophet. Not Biblical Prophet. Prophet, P-R-O-F-I-T. Anybody ever see this? So it's another reality show. And it's where this man, actually he's from Chicago. He goes into businesses that are dying. Like they have died. So I just watched one. And he went into this business, this car dealership in Morton Grove. And this car dealership is like, you've never seen anything like it. You walk into the doors and it's got, the whole ceiling is clouds and, I mean, beautiful. More than, I think, $10,000 mural on the ceiling. There is the waiting room for the customers. First of all, is huge. It's as big as any car dealership you've ever seen. And it's the waiting room for the customers. And there are 20 of those nice loungy massage seats. There are video arcades. There are movie screens. There is everything. I mean, it's amazing. There are only 20 cars on the lot, and all the cars are more than 50,000. They're all used. I think the lowest was 50,000. Most of them were really, really high end. So the man is losing left and right. He has no customers, and there's this gorgeous, and he keeps saying, but this is what I, this is how I envisioned it. This would be a destination place for people to come. And you're thinking, really? So anyways, so the program is this man who is very wealthy. He's done a lot of, the guy put over $3 million in building this place. So this other man says, I'm going to come and rescue your business. Here's the deal. I'm going to give you $3.5 million to redo your business because he's now in debt for $1.5 million. I'm going to give you, I'm literally just going to give it to you. But the deal is I'm 100% control. I'm going to flip this around and I'm 100% control. And the man's desperate. And of course he says, yeah, let's do that. But immediately, you know, the guy starts to change. The first thing he does is he takes off the mural off the wall. Oh, he's got these rock waterfalls. He starts selling all the stuff off. And the guy's, you know, having panic attacks. But I've made this for a place for people to come as a destination. He goes, people want to come and get their stuff and get out. They don't want to go to the auto place. But I kept thinking about that because this guy could not let go. And he was making all these changes, and the guy could not let go. And at one point, the guy says, that's it, the deal's off. And the investor says, sorry, the deal's already been made. You said I could be 100% in charge, and that means I will make all the decisions here. And in me making all the decisions, you're going to get your money back, and you're going to start making money, and you're going to actually have a life. And the man, of course, by the end of it, the man is in tears. Literal tears. He's just sobbing. And he says, so they have a grand opening, and this is the best day of my life. You have saved my life. And I just watched that, and I thought, oh my gosh, that's us. That's so us. That's the commitment to covenant is, all right, God, I'm taking my hands off. I commit to letting you 100% in charge, no matter what it takes, no matter how much you have to rip out of my life, that I have said, but this is a good thing. This is, I've spent so much money doing this, and I've done this for good reasons. And God says, and if I rip it out, you're going to have to let me rip it out. So that's the covenant that they're making, because they actually say, we're going to keep your laws now. We're going to listen to your instructions. We're going to listen to everything you say, and we're going to do it. And they name two things specifically. They name, we're not going to intermarry anymore, and we're going to keep the Sabbath. Why do you think they named these two out of everything else? Think about them.
Those were closest to them? Like, they were the most recognizable? Or?
Yeah, they were most recognizable because those are what got them kicked out of the land. Those are the two things. Intermarrying with foreigners, in other words, literally, like there, going, loving other idols, loving other things rather than God, and not keeping the Sabbath, because that gives us the time to recognize all the graces that God has given us, that we've been living in grace, and that it's been God all along. And they didn't keep that. And so those were the two things that got them kicked out of the land. And so they make a commitment, and they specifically say, and this is why I had you write down your things. You specifically say, these are things that have disconnected me, but you have been graceful and covered those things. And I'm so grateful to those. I want to continue to live in your grace with eyes wide open, that I am living in your grace, covering me all the time, so that this joy is a commitment to joy. I am committed to living in the midst of grace, seeing that you're covering me all the time, seeing that you're always in the couch, so that the minute I've turned to some Aubrey, I'm right there. Oh, wait, you're covering this. I'm coming right back to you. I'm coming. I'm there. I'm committed to doing that. And what he basically says is, this is a commitment to not neglect your presence. Because he says, the very last verse, we will not neglect the temple anymore, your house, your presence. I'm committed to not neglecting your presence. So even in that nursing home, when I'm sitting with my other lover, my commitment is to, oh, wait, you're here, you're here, you're here. Not here to punish me, here to make sure that the connection stays. I want to live in that. I want to live in that grace that you're still here, that you're still here. That's where I want to be living. That's a commitment to joy. is to not neglect his presence, to not take it for granted, but also to not leave it open to compromise, and to not, and to be able to give it freely to others as well. So, looking at joy, it is this idea that we come to know the extent of grace, that from knowing the extent of grace, that this gratitude literally bubbles up, and we understand the life-giving source is from grace, that the grace of his presence in all of our lives, in all the pieces of our lives, in all the places of our lives, is actually what brings us this great joy. So that, you know, if I were to summarize, that in order to do that, in order to have understanding of the extent of grace, I need to continually go back to that cycle of putting myself under him, so that my emotional center comes under him, that I bow before him, that I praise him, but that I bow before him, that I put my mind to thinking about the grace of his presence and the grace of his discipline and the grace of him giving me awareness that discipline is good. But that I also participate in it, so that I put myself under God by doing these things, by putting my heart, my mind, and my strength under his grace, knowing that grace is what is holding it all together. But also keeping myself open to God filling me with his words, filling me with what he wants to say to me all the time, which of course means I'm going to have to keep on making space. And I'm going to have to make more space in my life than I think possible. And this idea of allowing his voice to speak rather than mine is this making space. Rebecca, do you want to tell what's gone on in your family, or do you want me to read it?
Either or.
Why don't you say it?
So we've been working on changing the way we relate to one another. This year, since January particularly, both Nathan and I have just noticed a heaviness in our relationships with our daughters amongst one another. It's winter, there's lots of bickering, we live in close quarters. And Nate and I both have just, as we've been learning and going through this study together, have just really seen the disconnect between the way that we discipline our children, mm-hmm. and we rule over them versus living in relationship with them, with the Lord. Mm-hmm. And so we've been working on naming worth, and we've removed consequences, we've removed punishment. The days have just slowed to a crawl, the afternoons, as things come up, as the girls are doing homework and there's fighting, we pause life, we stop in that moment. And we gather, and it's this daily thing of, okay, let's stop. Who's feeling afraid, and why? What are you afraid of losing? What are you trying to get for yourself? And then they are able to kind of think through and talk through out loud what's going on, share it together, share it with us, and then they ask each other for forgiveness all by themselves without us, like saying, okay, go work it out, or go apologize, or whatever, which is what we've typically done. It's taking an enormous amount of time. But it's really been, it's been beautiful to hear them begin to do it on their own upstairs, or so wherever they are in the house, as they're coming up against their flesh, as they're coming up against one another's flesh, to hear them accuse each other of, you're not naming my birth. or to just say, oh, you know, things are being initiated in their own hearts as they're beginning to kind of hear the Holy Spirit and their safety to to turn back toward the Lord, to reorient, to be facing the Lord again instead of away toward their idols, my idols, their flesh. It's been good.
I love that.
Slow.
She had emailed me that, and I got to share it at the retreat, and it was like the perfect, like people went, oh, that's what it looks like when you name worth. And Rebecca said that when they're arguing, instead of saying, you know, stop that, this is who you really are. And I love that you said when they apologize with each other, it's not, I'm sorry I hit you, whatever it was. It's, I'm sorry for the attitude underneath. That just comes out of them when they've been hearing their worth named. I mean,
yes.
It is such a paradigm shift. Like, oh my goodness. So cool. So that when we open to God's way of doing things, let him fill us with, this is who you are. You name worth. This is who you are. And you name worth. That even though it sounds to us like, and I know when I read that, when Rebecca says, so we're not dealing with the issue. And what do we say? What do you mean you're not dealing with the issue? We're naming worth instead. It is definitely different than what we expect. But God says, could you make space for that? Just see. Just see. I love it. It's almost like in, where is it, in Micah, or where he talks about, would you just test me and see that I don't open wide the storehouses? And that's exactly what you're doing. And you're seeing he has opened wide the storehouses. Open, you have to be willing to continually be open to letting him fill you with what he says. Not with what we think is a good idea, but what he says. To allow us to fill that. And allow us to fill our lives, each other's lives, with his story. Rather than our stories all the time. What about his story? And he'll just keep that. And we begin to, I mean, as a teacher, the first thing you're taught in school, if you're going to be a teacher, is the idea of that you can, if you go in with an idea of what one little kid is like, they'll become that, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. Well, that's pretty much what God says. Tell them who they really are. Let them live into that. This is what I'm doing, as God says. This is what I'm doing. I keep telling you who you are. I want you to live into that. So listen to him. You've got to take time and make time to allow God's words to be telling you who you are, who he is, so that we become that rather than something else. So we need to put ourselves under God, but keep open to God continuing to fill us with his story. And then we need to make sure that we're walking with that grace all the time. Like we're married. Like we have other eyes to show us. Oh, this is grace. This is God covering you with his presence here. So that we continually practice relying on listening to his word, changing my perspective of what's going on in my life. If I go out and try to be joyful, it's not going to happen. What we're trying then is we're trying to be happy. We're trying to feel good. That's not what joy is about. Joy is really about understanding the extent of grace. The amazing, overwhelming extent. Not just the breadth, but the depth of the grace that he's given us.
Jill, I have an interesting kind of story connecting up all of these dots of naming and tending and being vulnerable and having it hurt. I have a dear friend that she's been a really good friend of mine for a long time. I didn't ask her to be in my bridal party, which was like an awful conversation. And we hadn't spoken for about a week, and after Bible study last week, I was like, man, in the conversation we had, I tried to name, like, I was trying to say, like, I still really care about you, but mm-hmm. she just wasn't in a place to hear that. Mm-hmm. And so after Bible study last week, I was talking with Annie and Robin after. I was like, I really, like, don't know what to do, and got home, emailed her, and my email was very, like, I want to move forward, and then I sent a paragraph of why I thought she was valuable. Mm-hmm. I'm like, I appreciate, like, I really care about you, you've been a really great friend, blah, blah, blah. She doesn't really respond for 2 days. Mm-hmm. And her response was like ripping me apart. Mm. It was like, you devalue me, like everything. I was like, that's so not what I like. And she just reminded all, like, you need to be, like, you hurt me, you hurt me, you hurt me, you hurt me. And I was like, okay. Like, my initial response, like, I wrote a mean response. And I deleted it because I was like, no, but you did, like, my initial flesh self wanted to say, like, but you did this to me and you did this to me. And I said, I was sitting in my car and waiting to go into Hobby Lobby. Like, reading this, I was like, hey, like, I can't do that. That's not naming her value or giving her space. Mm-hmm. So I responded, and I said, I'm sorry to hear that you have felt devalued. That has never been my heart. I hope you would know that. And then I was like, I'm going to give you space. Like, she didn't say, like, I don't want to be your friend, but everything in that email sounded like that. And so I said, I know that I want a relationship with you if you're not in that place. Okay. Like, and she responded, it's continued a bit, but like, and it is definitely not restorative yet, or I don't feel like we're in a place of reconciliation. Mm-hmm. But my last 2 days of working with kids has been so joyful. I feel like I have had these like pure conversations with kids about like, this is what it's like to like lay down yourself and say, I have to allow space and what like, and it has nothing to do with her.
No.
And it's so what God is teaching me of all of this.
Yes.
I don't know. It's been like a really, like I've gotten home on Monday and Tuesday of this week and been like, I had a really good day. Like, and they've been awful hard conversations with kids. Like it's, they've been very painful, but it's been very like, wow, this is so what this all looks like.
Yeah.
It's been difficult and it's been, but it, I mean,
but there's joy.
There's tons of, and that's what I, like, I literally have gotten home each night and been like, this day's been hard, but I feel full.
Yes.
Which is the like, it feels so contradictory of the like, empty happiness. We're like, I had a really good time.
Right.
Anyway, it just is like, and then of course I can't like disconnect that I'm in a season of engagement of like clearing space to like, to be reminded.
Yes.
Because I have a physical thing on my body that can't, like, it's just been like rocking me in a really like a really good
And it's so deep, right? That's what you're feeling. Yeah, like, right? Just this deepness of it.
Yeah. It's been really wonderful. I mean, it's been tearful and hard and change and like all of those things, but it has felt so, I don't think I've, even when you were describing listening, I'm like, I feel that of like giving myself space to listen before I react or like listen before I, I don't know. It's, it's been great.
Yeah.
I feel like it's absolutely really Holy Spirit driven.
Yeah.
In all facets.
That's so good.
So.
That's so good. I think that giving space piece is a piece that we've often neglected. And because it's hard, right? That's just like hard, like, because giving space usually means that it looks like they don't want to take your tending and your naming, which is that was the picture, right? I mean, to me, that's why I can watch that 300 times and still cry, because I think that God's doing that every day. Every day he sits there and gives me space, and when I'm ready, he's ready. He's right there. And the depth of that, I think, is the joy that we're looking for, and that, because like Natalie said, it fills us. So the joy fills us. It doesn't make us happy. It fills us. It makes us whole, which is what we're living toward, which is what he is doing.
Jill, I was also thinking, like, in Rebecca's story, immediately I'm like, okay, what does that look like? What does it look like in my life? And I was thinking, like, how many times, right, we just do the, like, stop it, apologize. Like, do you know what I mean? Just, and I'm like, okay, what is that? And it's really just me trying to get back to my Peter Panel's house.
Right,
like,
right.
I need to get back to what I'm building.
Right.
You know what I mean? I'm building stuff today.
Yes.
You're totally getting in the way of my building.
Right.
So just apologize, you know?
Yes.
And I'm just like, oh, my goodness. Like, that
means, besides slowing down, it means my building projects need to be totally put aside. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And that's super bowing down.
Yes, it is. Thing too, yes, it
know?
Is.
Like, whatever it is that I thought had to happen
yep.
today, I
yep.
need to give that up too. Or else,
yeah.
I am just giving my kids a message of,
right.
you know, this. Just do it so we can keep doing our own thing with
right.
our whole verse. Mm-hmm.
Right,
you know?
Right, exactly, exactly. Yeah, yeah. So these, and this helps so much, both of you, mm-hmm. to share your vulnerability and where you are. It gives us concrete stuff to hold on to, like, oh, and for you to struggle with, okay, what does that look like? Yeah, it does mean slowing down. It does mean giving space. It does mean really saying no to a lot of things. Because we, not only do we want to be whole, but don't we want that for others, mm-hmm. For the people we love?
Mm-hmm.
And is it going to be hard? It's going to be tremendously hard. It is. But it's life. It's what we're looking for here.
It's like sharing space with a young married couple and a one-year-old. It has just like,
yeah. Right.
This way of life. Now it's like almost every room in the house has stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So in my head, I'm thinking, okay, how can I help you declutter? But then I'm starting to do some work that I'm not supposed to be doing other than just allowing
exactly.
for the season of
yes.
loving and caring
yep.
for Riley.
Yeah, mm-hmm. right.
And going, okay, I got to back off the bus and this steering wheel and all those things.
Yeah.
It's just stuff in the house. It's just a house.
Right.
So
right.
what are we building here?
Yeah.
So again, it's going to have to work
yes.
as opposed to when you pick up all this stuff.
Yeah.
So it's
pretty amazing. There's a PhD student in our class who is our the teaching assistant, and he's a Chinese man getting his PhD so he can go back to China and establish seminaries.
Mm-hmm.
So he had a group of his Chinese co-workers from China come and visit the United States, and they came and visited all the colleges, all the seminaries, several seminaries. And he said that they were blown away by our abundance. He said, not physical abundance, because they knew that we had that, but our abundance of, like, we don't even know what to do with. They visited the Crystal Cathedral and saw that, you know, if you know that, that kind of, they felt that church fell apart. They couldn't sell the building, and so they finally sold it to the Roman Catholic diocese there. And that this is what they came away with, and I thought this was great. The man said, so what have you learned from the United States and the seminaries and how to build? Because, I mean, we do have fantastic seminaries. We do have great places. And he said, they said, we've learned that we need to invest in people, not things. And that's the idea, right? We're so invested in other things rather than whole people, to invest in whole people, our whole self and whole people. And that's it takes time for us to invest in other things, but if we invest in people, that's going to take time
mm-hmm.
as well, and space, and that's very dynamic, which is probably why we don't like to do it so much, because that means we never know from day to day what it's going to look like. So we need to understand that joy is very important. It is important as a wall, because it protects the integrity of God's faithfulness. And if there is anything that the world needs to know, it is God is faithful. And that his faithfulness covers our unfaithfulness. Because joy also serves as a gate, because it invites us into a place that can be faithful for us. Because every one of us as human beings knows, we're just impossibly unfaithful. And for joy to stand out there saying, our God is faithful. Our God is so faithful. Look at how faithful our God is. That becomes not just a wall to protect his integrity of his faithfulness, but this huge gate that says, come on in, because this faithfulness will cover your unfaithfulness. It's huge. But lastly, and here's an interesting thing. Joy is a gift for the Lord. It's something we actually give him. We always talk about that verse, the joy of the Lord is our strength. But actually, most people who read the Hebrew actually think it's flipped from what we think. We think that our joy in the Lord is our strength. In Hebrew, they believe it actually means the Lord's joy is that we are strong. The Lord's joy is that we are strong temples, places that actually protect the integrity of God's wholeness, of his faithfulness, and that we are strong in protecting the gates that come to him. That gives God joy when we're strong. And I love that. I've never read that before. I never heard that. And we're looking at it in Hebrew and going, wow, I never thought about the joy of the Lord being God's joy, being in our strength. Our strength of being temples that protect the integrity of who he is and of his faithfulness. That it gives him great joy for us to be strong in our unity and in our fear of him, but also in that joy of living in his grace. So I've finished a little bit early, but I think, I don't know, for me this joy one, it seemed very simple, and yet one of those that kind of digs down a little deeper. I hope that that's what we go away with for this. It's always hard for us to have a week off and then to come back. I hope that kind of a new picture of joy inhabits your next 2 weeks, and that you begin to inhabit that joy of living in his grace. For me, I mean, I want to build a hut right now. And I noticed when I was gone over the weekend, Bill tucked down all my bushes on the side here, so I actually have the stuff to build a hut. So if you see a hut in the middle of my lawn, no, it's I'm living in his grace. This is where I'm living here. Yeah?
There's this really short little article about the huts in Skokie.
Oh, okay. Oh, read it. Yeah, yeah.
So the title is Sukkah in Downtown Skokie Reminds Jews of Creation, Connection, and Unity. So the sukkah is sitting in the park at Oakton and now Center Road in downtown Skokie this week, ready to accommodate those who want to celebrate the Jewish holiday of Sukkot. The rabbi of the Lubavitch Shabbat Skokie Synagogue was at Sukkot Monday, ready to welcome visitors who might want to eat their meals there. He explained that Jews eat meals in, spend time in, and maybe even sleep in these impermanent structures, which do not have real roofs, only twigs and branches. And the rudimentary structures remind people of their connection to God. For this week, we're reminded it's not about the physical and materialistic. It's about the spiritual. It's to remind us that everything in this world is temporary and the important things that will last forever. He held a bundle of plant leaves in a citron called etrog in Hebrew, explaining that the plants, myrtle, willow, and palm, are all different. A reminder that God calls his people to welcome those who are different. Mm-hmm. It's a holiday of unity. All of us are children of God, created in God's image. We all have a spark of who God is. So I thought that was beautiful. And just that he set it up and said, anybody who wants to celebrate and make space and not build their cedar paneled houses for a week can come.
I love it. Wow.
We got to go.
Yes.
Not just visit, go have a meal.
I know, that's what I was just,
sleep there.
Yes.
So the youth group at this thing, they do sushi and Sukkot. So they have like a sushi party in their temporary structure.
I'm in. We're in. Me and you
know. Well, anybody else have anything to share about that? I'm going to miss you guys for the next 2 weeks, although I will get a lot of work done at school. So let me pray. Father, thank you. I find it funny, God, that I want to say I'm so joyful. And it's not this exuberant. It's this deepness of knowing you're still sitting on the couch. Father, would that be the place we live this week and next as we enter into our own celebration of your revelation of connecting us again? May we live and share your grace. In your name we pray, amen. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.